You know, it's very easy to make a complaint against somebody. It'll never go anywhere. It'll never be taken up by the committee.
Senator Murkowski's EPA amendment draws an ethics complaint from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 13th of January. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, getting the problem of suicide out in the open.
We're at such a crisis that we need to directly talk about suicide.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The environmental group Greenpeace has filed a Senate ethics complaint against Senator Lisa Murkowski for consulting lobbyists as she wrote an amendment. But Murkowski and her staff say the criticism is overblown and that her office did nothing wrong. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senator Murkowski is concerned about the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to regulate greenhouse gases at stationary sources like power plants and factories. She says setting new pollution limits could hurt jobs and the economy. So she tried to introduce an amendment last fall stopping the EPA by calling for a one-year timeout so Congress could craft its own legislation dealing with pollution. Murkowski's spokesman on the Senate Energy Committee, Robert Dillon, says she sought input from the EPA but didn't get a response, so her staff turned to outsiders for help.
The EPA did not return her calls, dodged her efforts to speak with them. And so who was she supposed to turn to make sure that her legislation did not do anything unintended? Who better to do that than former public servants that served in the high positions of the EPA under the former administration?
Those former EPA officials worked for the Bush administration and are now lobbyists at powerful D.C. firms representing high-profile clients like utilities and coal companies. That's not who Greenpeace thinks should have an input on energy legislation. Kurt Davies runs the environmental group's website, Polluter Watch. He says lobbyists have too much influence in crafting bills.
This is just another case in point. It's a nasty one because these are ex-Bush officials who spent their entire careers in power trying to obstruct those same laws. And now they're working for the polluters.
But Senator Murkowski says Greenpeace and other environmental groups are way off base. She says the lobbyists only gave legal advice and were among many people consulted.
We discussed it with some of our Democratic colleagues. We discussed it with some of the experts in the area of Clean Air Act and attempted to ensure that we were not raising any issues in terms of unintended consequences with that legislation.
But Kurt Davies with Greenpeace says it doesn't matter who else Murkowski's team talked to. He says the lobbyists have much to gain if the legislation goes their way. Davies filed a complaint with the Senate Ethics Committee Tuesday.
And the fact that they have consulted with numerous groups or that, you know, many people have chimed in on this count of how and what to be done with the EPA's authority is really inconsequential. The revelation that heavy polluter industry lobbyists have had their hands on the steering wheel of the Senate effort to undermine the EPA is something that has to be reckoned with.
One of the lobbyists under scrutiny is Jeff Homestead, who heads the Environmental Strategies Group with the lobbying firm Bracewell Giuliani. He says his involvement was always out in the open, and Democratic staffers attended one of his conference calls.
It's just kind of silly to say that somehow industry lobbyists were the ones who wrote this, and that's just not true. So we were consulted, and I like to think we gave them good advice, but we were not the ones behind it, certainly.
Homestead says eyeballing legislation is typical for lobbyists who've held jobs with past administrations. He says he wasn't paid by the Senate or by his energy company clients for his work.
I would say that this happens I mean, it doesn't happen to me every day, but I can tell you that certainly in terms of the way Washington works, this happens constantly all the time, that members of Congress and more typically their staffs reach out to people who they know in town who are experts in a certain area to make sure that they understand exactly what it would mean, because these statutes are pretty complicated.
Murkowski staffer Robert Dillon says the ethics complaint filed by Greenpeace is a distraction from the issue of EPA regulations.
You know, it's very easy to make a complaint against somebody. It'll never go anywhere. It'll never be taken up by the committee, but now they get to make a headline saying, oh, there's an ethics complaint, the Senator Murkowski.
In 2008, the Senate Ethics Committee received 85 complaints. In that same year, only 10 cases warranted preliminary inquiry, and just two of those led to private letters of admonition. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A three-day gathering of tribal and state agencies focused on the staggering numbers of suicides in Alaska wrapped up today in Anchorage. Brenda Moore, chair of the statewide Suicide Prevention Council, says the summit is the first time such a broad cross-section of people have gathered to focus on what works and how to replicate it. She says they'll be developing a web portal to compile resource material.
Then we're going to be looking at the challenges. Okay, what is it that are the barriers? Where and then actually trying to look at how we might be able to fill in some of the gaps and the holes that we see that are problems in having a robust system and safety net in place.
She expressed frustration that despite multiple efforts, the rates of suicide continue to be so much higher in Alaska than in other parts of the nation. Moore says the problems that lead to suicide are complex. She says the bleak economic conditions in rural Alaska are one of the bigger problems.
Economic well-being has to be a huge part of looking at how to address the problem of suicide, because without economic well-being, people do lose hope.
Moore says a big challenge is having proper systems in place to document what does work in the area of prevention and early intervention. She says the legislature pushes for documented outcomes, but she says this is an area where efforts have not excelled. Dr. Kathy Graves is the director of Behavioral Health and Rural Services for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Dr. Graves says the consortium is focused on training a broad spectrum of people beyond health professionals, so there are more Alaskans alert for signs of trouble within their family or their community.
We're trying to hit every level because we know that sometime within 6 months of a suicide attempt, many people have seen a healthcare provider who, if they're trained properly, can recognize those signs and symptoms and reach out.
Graves says there are excellent programs in villages where elders and youth are coming together to build on cultural strength. She cites a program in Barrow getting more youth involved in whaling and says programs at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Center also show promise, but getting the conversation started has been difficult. This is important, she says, calling the enormous suicide problem in the state an epidemic.
We're at such a crisis that we need to directly talk about suicide. It's been difficult for some people to even use the word suicide. So training people how to talk about it and how to directly address the issue, that to me is what's needed.
James Galanos is with the state's Division of Behavioral Health, Prevention, and Early Intervention Services. He says the rates of suicide in Alaska remain among the highest of all states, and since 2005, there has been an incremental increase. Young Alaska Native males have the highest rate, 3 to 5 times above the rest of the nation. Galano says there's been significant increases in military members and the rates in the northwest area of the state, particularly the regions around Nome and Kotzebue.
We're also seeing significant rates in the Bethel region. We're also seeing some pockets of high rates in the interior as well. And Southeast Alaska, traditionally, they've seen lower rates than the state average, but we've we've had several communities in the Southeast region that really had significant rates of suicide, Ketchikan being one of them.
Galano says there's been 13 suicides in the Ketchikan area in the last 12 months. He says there is a perception that the majority of Alaska suicides happen in rural Alaska, but he says this isn't accurate. He says about 55% of the state's residents live in urban areas, and 55% of suicides happen there. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, fishermen react to the Navy's plan to step up war games in the Gulf of Alaska.
The areas of upwelling and ocean currents combine to make a training area like no other. That's exactly the same reason the Navy should not operate there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
30 below temperatures in Fairbanks this week underlined the urgency of getting homeless people off the streets. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, state housing officials met with local service providers yesterday to discuss a new approach to dealing with homeless inebriates.
The approach known as Housing First is premised on providing chronic drinkers a place to live as the first step to getting them on the road to a better life. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation provides funding for a range of homeless programs, and AHFC Director Dan Fowski told Fairbanks service providers Housing First also makes economic sense.
I'm a true believer in it is cheaper to house people than it is to incarcerate them or place them in hospitals or emergency rooms. If you look at the science and the work, it is without question cheaper to house.
Much of the growing interest in Housing First in Alaska is based on a well-studied facility in Seattle that's reduced that city's costs related to dealing with chronic street drinkers. Sometimes derided as bunks for drunks, Housing First has proved a viable alternative for dealing with inebriates. Alaska Mental Health Trust Land CEO Jeff Jesse said it comes down to local choice.
There is no free ride for the community. You are going to pay one way or the other. You just have to choose. Are you going to pay by using your public safety resources to chase them around, or are you going to pay to actually try to house them?
Jesse says Seattle's Housing First facility has stopped the cycling of people through the city's law enforcement and emergency assistance programs, and most residents of the center reduce their drinking. Fairbanks' existing homeless programs provide emergency help, but there's no long-term housing option. Cindy Fields, Community Service Director for Fairbanks Immaculate Conception Church, which runs a weekend soup kitchen, says she's convinced the Housing First approach is a good way to go.
Give them a place to live. Give them dignity and respect. Treat the disease of alcoholism as a disease and mental health issues as social problems for us all. But tackle it with love and compassion and consideration, and we'll make progress.
Fields is part of a coalition of individuals that represent a range of social service groups organizing to pursue a Housing First project in Fairbanks. The AHFC's Mark Romick outlined government and private funding options, but underscored the importance of a coordinated approach.
If you're interested in something like this, first thing is find an experienced sponsor. Okay, this is not a program for the faint of heart. And please don't create a new nonprofit. Use an existing nonprofit. There's already enough nonprofits. You have some great nonprofits in Fairbanks. And then once you go through that stuff, is really look at the feasibility. And you have to look at the feasibility of all three legs of the stool. Are you going to get enough money to build it? Once you build it, is there enough operating money to pay for all the utilities and the management of the facility itself? And then where are you going to get the support service money?
Romick said more money is available for capital investment than day-to-day operations and encouraged consideration of renovation of an existing building as opposed to more costly new construction. Anchorage is looking at conversion of a former motel into a Housing First facility. The Fairbanks Downtown Association brought federal officials to town last fall to introduce the idea and organized this week's meeting. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Three environmental groups are suing to block the logjam timber sale on Southeast's Prince of Wales Island. They say the Forest Service's timber cutting plan would threaten wolves, deer, and salmon. The timber industry says the lawsuit threatens one of the last mills operating in the Tongass National Forest. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
Late last year, Viking Lumber of Klawock spent $1.8 million for the right to cut about 24 million board feet of timber in what's called the logjam sale. About twice that amount could be sold later. The sale area covers about 3,400 acres of forest between Thorn Bay and Kaufman Cove on east-central Prince of Wales Island. Three groups are suing to stop the sale, or at least force the Forest Service to reevaluate its environmental impacts. The Tongass Conservation Society, Cascadia Wildlands, and Greenpeace say logging the area would harm wildlife, particularly the Alexander Archipelago wolf. Sitka's Larry Edwards, a Greenpeace spokesman, says the Forest Service broke federal rules when it approved the timber sale.
We are suing because there were serious violations in preparing the environmental impact statement, violating the National Environmental Policy Act and the National Forest Management Act. The latter one of those should be protecting the sustainability of wolves in the area.
The Forest Service had no immediate comment on the lawsuit. Spokesman Ray Massey in the agency's Juneau office says staff attorneys just began reviewing the allegations. But the agency defended the logjam sale in response to earlier administrative appeals from the three environmental groups and other organizations. Officials said their plan focused on an area that had already been logged, not pristine wilderness, and they said it provided enough protection for wildlife. Viking Lumber owner Kirk Dahlstrom, who won the logjam contract, did not return a call asking for comment. But Owen Graham of the Ketchikan-based industry group, Alaska Forest Association, said he recently spoke to the company.
They've told me that without this timber sale, they can't keep operating for another year. And the Forest Service tells me they have no timber sales to substitute for this one within the next couple of years. So we've got to make this timber sale work.
Viking is Southeast Alaska's largest operating mill. Similar mills in Ketchikan and Wrangell have stopped or reduced operations in recent years. The logjam lawsuit does not include the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, the region's largest environmental organization. Juneau-based SEAC filed appeals last year asking for less logging and more wildlife protection, and it proposed a smaller sale plan it said would keep the industry alive. But Conservation Director Buck Lindekugel says the group decided against legal action.
We are trying to change an approach from confrontation to working with other stakeholders to identify common ground and move forward. And all-or-nothing approaches in court are not really conducive to sending the message that we're willing to talk and work towards an agreeable common ground with different folks.
The logjam lawsuit was filed January 11th. It's not clear when it will go before a judge. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
The city of Anchorage is preparing to end its campaign to inoculate residents against the H1N1 flu. The municipality will hold its last two free clinics this month. City officials are considering the vaccination push a success. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The deputy director of Anchorage's Health and Human Services Department, Jason Smart, says the campaign has gone well, especially when considering the federal government's early difficulty supplying the vaccine. Smart tallied the inoculation numbers, beginning with the first 7 free vaccination clinics.
We've vaccinated a little over 5,600 individuals through those clinics.
We also had in Anchorage an opportunity to provide vaccine through a large campaign through the Anchorage School District. And the school district was successful in vaccinating over 19,000 school district students in the months of November and December.
Overall, a total of about 80,000 doses have been distributed to the municipality, school district, and other medical providers and pharmacies in Anchorage. In January's free clinics, people don't have to be in a priority group to receive the vaccine. Smart also says the Municipal Health Department made a concerted effort to include groups in Anchorage who may speak little or no English.
We worked with folks in the cultural communities that could serve as translators, who volunteered, came to these large public clinics and met several folks that were in those individual communities to kind of assist with, you know, getting vaccinated and dealing with language barriers. And we saw good success with a couple of our clinics where those folks were targeted.
And the department sought out another group of Anchorage residents.
We did some specific outreach to local shelters to target those folks that, due to, you know, other underlying health conditions and other issues, that was a specific targeted group that we've had some good success in getting vaccinated.
Dr. Bruce Chandler is the department's medical officer.
Even though a lot of people have received the vaccination, the more who choose to get vaccinated now, the better we're protected in the future.
Dr. Chandler adds that often when media attention pretty much abandons a health issue, the public succumbs to complacency. He says individuals indulging in such false security are ignoring two important facts.
Many people who haven't been immunized remain at risk, and the best way to protect yourself as well as your family and the people around you is to get vaccinated.
This is Len Anderson.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council is questioning the Navy's plan to conduct more extensive war games in the Gulf of Alaska. The Navy is presenting a draft environmental impact statement on the proposal to a handful of Alaska's coastal communities. But Dave Kubiak, the chairman of the board for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, says the Navy could not have picked a more problematic place from the perspective of commercial fishermen to conduct undersea military maneuvers. He read the Navy's reasons for wanting to use the Gulf from the draft EIS.
The unique and complex bathymetric and oceanographic environment in the TMMA presents a challenging ASW warfare training opportunity. The complexity of sea bottom, the input of freshwater into the sea, the areas of upwelling and ocean currents combine to make the area a training area like no other. That's exactly the same reason the Navy should not operate training exercises there, because all those things they name that are so great and so neat for training make them so rich in biodiversity.
There are three alternatives to the draft EIS. The first is a no-action alternative, which means no change in naval activities in the Gulf. Alternative one includes the use of sonar and maneuvers lasting 21 days instead of 2 weeks. The last is the preferred alternative, which includes the sonar and extended time frame and adds a second training session per summer and includes the sinking of derelict ships with various weaponry. The Navy's Matt Hahn explained why such realistic war games are preferred.
It's a preferred alternative because it would fully support the level and type of training that the Navy and the Joint Forces would need. There's an old saying, train as you fight, and you know, the more you train in peacetime, the less you bleed in war. Those are kind of axioms, but they're true, and so we want to make it as realistic as we can. Obviously, there's safety that needs to be required.
Kubiak says he supports the Navy's need to train, but thinks there is a better alternative.
They could have put it out further west, and I don't want to step on my western neighbors, but there's a lot of country out there where the continental shelf is a lot narrower, but you still have canyons, and you still have currents, and you still have water mixtures.
The Navy has held open houses so far in Kodiak, Anchorage, Homer, and Juneau. Today they're in Cordova. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has granted hundreds of thousands of dollars to the University of Alaska Fairbanks to study the impacts of some invasive plant species. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
A four-year scientific project will get started this spring thanks to $494,000 in grant funding announced late last week by the Alaska Congressional Delegation. The project is titled, Are Alaskan Pollinators Abandoning Native Berries for Exotic Clover? The project lead is Krista Mulder with the Institute of Arctic Biology at UAF. She says the project is intended to study a specific impact that invasive plant species might be having on fruit production in Alaska.
So we're interested in knowing whether these exotic plants were changing the pollinator availability for the native plants. And there's a couple of different ways they could do that. First of all, they could simply be attracting all the pollinators to themselves, and so there just aren't as many pollinators to go to the native plants. Another thing that they could be doing is they could be attracting pollinators in the general area, and so there's just as many pollinators visiting the plants, but the pollen that they're delivering is not of the right species. It's of the exotic plant rather than the native plant. And this is something that people have found in other places is a common way that exotic plants affect native plants.
The research project is intended to answer several questions, including how does invasive species management influence fruit production through changes in pollinator service? In the grant proposal, Mulder noted that this question is of particular importance in areas of the country such as Alaska, where traditional agricultural systems are not well developed and managed natural systems play an important role in the food supply. Mulder says it's possible that the invasive plants could be having a positive impact on native berries.
In areas where the flowering overlap time isn't that big, the exotic plants may actually be providing resources for the bees at times when they otherwise wouldn't get very much, and so their populations may actually be bigger, and they may be able to sustain higher populations of pollinators and feed back to positive effects on the native plants. So those are the kinds of things that we're interested in.
From 1941 to 2006, the number of non-native plants recorded in Alaska increased by 46%, and in some parts of the state, the non-native plants have begun to form extensive populations. Alaska is in a different position than the lower 48 states in that the cold climate, geographic barriers, and the small population reduced the chances of non-native plants getting established. However, the recent warmer winters, growing population, and increase in commerce has led to the potential of non-native plant species spreading to other areas of Alaska. The species of specific focus for the research project is sweet clover, which includes a larger flowered yellow form and a smaller flowered white form. They're both invasive to the state of Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.